Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
With me, Crispin Mwakideu in Bonn. Good morning and thanks for joining me on this program. Our main stories this Tuesday, 9th of June. Several African leaders have met with G7 leaders in Bavaria, southern Germany. What came out of that meeting?
There were quite a few topics that were important to the African leaders. There was the commitment to pledge or to re-pledge 0.7% of their GDP to overseas development assistance, a lot of which will obviously go to Africa.
The United Nations accuses the Eritrean government of committing human rights abuses on its own citizens.
Most, if not all, of the people we've spoken with have spent some time in incarceration. If it's not themselves, then a family member has been or somebody in their neighbourhood has been incarcerated.
Plus, Germany hits the net 10 times against Ivory Coast in the ongoing FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. We shall find out why African ladies' team perform poorly in the global tournament. Stay tuned.
Top story.
And we begin in Bavaria, southern Germany, where the G7 summit wrapped up on Monday. Leaders of the world's seven biggest economies vowed to end the use of fossil fuels by the end of the century. The last day of the summit also focused on combating terrorism, economic development, and the role of women. The G7 leaders held discussions with African leaders from Tunisia, Algeria, Nigeria, and Senegal. More than 90 people in Nigeria have died from Boko Haram attacks since Muhammadu Buhari was sworn in. DW's Naomi Conrad was in Elmau, venue of the G7 summit, and she's been telling me more about the outcome.
There were quite a few topics that were important to the African leaders. There was the commitment to pledge or to re-pledge 0.7% of their GDP to overseas development assistance, a lot of which will obviously go to Africa. In other topics, though, there were less concrete pledges. There was a pledge to support renewables in Africa, to reduce hunger by 2030 by 500 million people, to support countries like Tunisia and Nigeria in their fight against extremists. But overall, we have very few concrete pledges, as is quite normal in these kind of fora.
So, in your opinion, do you have the impression that the African agenda was not properly addressed in the summit?
Well, it's not necessarily the right fora for the African agenda as such. I mean, development claims, development topics are often addressed at the G20 or indeed in UN fora, the G7 or the G8 as it was until Russia was expelled last year, typically address global topics such as climate change, trade, corruption.
Now, the president of Nigeria, Muhammadu Buhari, was reportedly asked to bring along a shopping list of what is needed to tackle Boko Haram. Do we know what was on that list?
No, we don't really know what's on that list. I mean, the president of Tunisia also made clear before he came here to G7 that he needed concrete commitments, that he was overwhelmed by Islamist fighters, in this case, in bordering Libya. The G7 did make a concrete commitment to help Tunisia secure its borders, to fight against destabilization in war-torn Libya. They made very strong statements on that. Statements towards Nigeria per se were a lot less concrete. As I said, they referred to more global commitments to fighting terror more globally, to reducing hunger, as I said, to securing global supply chains. So quite a wide-ranging plethora of topics that are important to Africa, but not Nigeria per se.
And we understand also that the issue of the Mediterranean refugees was also brought up. What more can you tell us about that?
It was brought up, and leaders, as they have done before, pledged to help refugees, but there were no concrete commitments. It was a very brief part of the communique, a mere paragraph where they repledged their commitment to help refugees to somehow tackle this crisis, but no concrete pledges were made.
Naomi Conrad speaking from Bavaria, venue of the G7 summit. Despite the presence of African leaders at the G7 summit, relations between the continent and developed nations have not always been cozy. Kenyans accused the European Union of blackmailing them into signing a recent trade deal. This report by Jochen Zierhut from Nairobi is now presented by Abubakar Jallo.
Here on the outskirts of Nairobi, Godfrey Nganga tends to his 1,500 chickens and 6 cows. He is a regular small-scale farmer, and there are thousands of farmers like him in Kenya. Nganga is worried that the power of the European market would be a threat to his livelihood.
They should be buying our produce, eggs, milk and poultry, but their technology is very good, and so they can sell their produce much cheaper than we can sell ours.
Nganga and other small-scale farmers are nervous because of the Economic Partnership Agreement, or EPA, signed between the European Union and the East African Community, the EAC, last year. After 10 years of talks with the EAC, that's Kenya, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania and Uganda, Brussels wanted to finally get round to signing a deal. But in Nairobi in particular, there was stiff resistance driven by the fear that the agricultural sector, a key segment of the Kenyan economy, would be unable to compete with the subsidized fruits and vegetables imported from the EU. The East Africans will retain their duty-free access to the European market, but that failed to impress critics like Frederick Njehu from the Kenyan Human Rights Commission.
And it's a very bad deal. If you look at the demands that the EU placed on the ESC, I do not see them handling what the EU has demanded, especially when you look at the liberalization, for instance, of 82.6. That means you're eliminating all your import tariffs over the next 15 years.
The 82.6 was a reference in percentage terms to the share of the Kenyan market that now has to be opened up to EU exporters. One Kenyan Economic Institute believes that the EPA is costing the country 100 million euros annually. This is money that is needed to boost the Kenyan economy. The EPA prohibits new levies on goods bound for export to the EU. But EAC countries want to introduce them temporarily anyway so as to prevent their economies from hemorrhaging or being bled dry. The EU's promotional video suggests that such fears are groundless.
The Economic Partnership Agreement is there to strengthen this partnership.
Last October, the EU flexed its muscles in the direction of Kenya, imposing duties of between 8.5% and 30% on Kenyan produce such as flowers, one of the country's major exports, as well as on coffee, tea and tinned pineapple. It was blackmail, as Kenyans observed bitterly. But that did not lessen the impact. A few weeks later, the Kenyan government signed the EPA. Many have criticized the EU's heavy-handed tactics, including the German government Africa Commissioner, Günther Nuke.
We transfer a lot of taxpayers' money to Africa in the shape of development programs. And one shouldn't set out to demolish with trade talks the very thing which we in the development ministry are trying to help to create.
That is a reference to sustained economic growth in Kenya. Economists at the United Nations have also voiced criticism of the EPA, saying it is much more of a threat than opportunity for East Africa.
Abubakar Jallo with that report written by Jochen Ziehout.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Eritrea is ruled by fear, not by law. That's a statement from a UN report detailing systematic and widespread human rights abuses in the Horn of Africa nation. The atrocities are driving some 5,000 Eritreans to flee every month, according to the nearly 500-page report. It accuses President Isaias Afwerki's iron-fisted regime of creating a repressive system in which people are routinely arrested, detained, tortured, killed, or simply go missing. Philip Sanna has been speaking to Sheila Kitharuth, a co-author of the UN report.
The point is very simple in terms of how you reach that there is, in fact, systematic, widespread and gross human rights violations, which is being committed in Eritrea under the authority of the government. Some of these violations, in fact, constitute crimes against humanity. Our investigations identified specific patterns of systematic human rights violations, and this is based on different factors. The type of violations we're talking about and the systemic nature of these violations, meaning that they cannot be the result of random or isolated act.
The government side may now claim that the results are not worth, as you have not been able to conduct your research inside the country. Have you been able to make sure that still you can say now the results are something that we can work with?
We would have liked, in fact, to be able to go to Eritrea and to conduct the investigations inside. But the government didn't respond to our request for information or invited us in the country. However, the kind of evidence we've collected from different people, different places, is such that it would be difficult to say that there is a sort of collusion around, you know, for us to get just this kind, the type of evidence we've been able to collect. It's so widespread. The way the information came to us and was analyzed, it's such a systematic way that we took every precaution necessary to ensure that what we found was indeed the kind of violations that people have suffered over a period of time, you know, from the time the country became independent to date.
5,000 Eritreans are driven to flee the country every month. Is this what makes people leave?
In fact, it's the scale and the scope of the human rights violations in the country which causes people. There is a direct link, I would say, between those leaving and enjoyment of human rights. People leave because of the widespread human rights violations in the country.
You also speak of a system of fear whereby people are arbitrarily detained.
By the people we've been interviewing and the submissions in writing we obtain, as I mentioned earlier, it's done in such a way that across the board, the frequency in terms of how these violations occur, we've been able to document and corroborate that, as well as the number of victims. Just to give you one example, for example, with regards to detention, most, if not all, of the people we've spoken with have spent some time in incarceration. If it's not themselves, then a family member has been, or somebody in their neighborhood has been incarcerated.
UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Eritrea, Sheila Kitharuth. You're listening to Africa Link from DW Studios in Bonn, Germany.
Africa on the Move.
Antique items like furniture, utensils and paintings were once considered as being exclusively for wealthy Europeans. But the classic decor items are now becoming popular amongst a rising middle class in Kenya. In fact, to respond to an increased demand, some entrepreneurs have specialized in stocking them. Patricia Kathure is one of them, and our correspondent Alfred Kitty met up with her in Nairobi.
Just next to Nairobi's posh suburb, Kabarnet Gardens, you find a household goods showroom, which is becoming popular among the middle class who want their homes to look peculiar or rather unique. The vintage decor is now the talk of the town. Speaking of the oldest of the old, you will find furniture, kitchenware and wardrobes dating back to 100 years. These items are displayed in a three-bedroom bungalow, which serves as the showroom, and Patricia Kadure is the proprietor.
We collect old things from Germany, then we bring them to Kenya. Let's say everything, house items, from utensils to furnitures to beds to war units. The things we are selling, they are reasonable prices.
Antiques are thought to be highly valued among Westerners and most often rich people. But middle-class Kenyans are now developing interest in vintage properties. Joseph Karanja, in his mid-30s, is a client who had come here to shop for household items.
Through a friend, I saw some unique items in her house, and I wanted to know exactly where I can get such an item, and I was directed to this place. These are items which you'll not get anywhere or easily in the Kenyan market.
Owned by two middle-aged women who worked in the diaspora for several years, the vintage decor is slowly becoming a popular source of antique furniture in Kenya. Proprietor Patricia Kadure says their target buyers are not only middle-class Kenyans.
We target everyone. We don't limit. The middle class can afford them. Everybody can afford them. We don't target the rich people. We target the middle class.
Antique furniture, however, does not have higher value among Kenyans who are living below the poverty line. For now, it's mostly middle class Kenyans and rich people who are taking interest in the items. Joseph Karanja explains why he prefers real antiques.
Most of what we have in the Kenya market is imitations of what used to be there some time back. But what we have at Vintage Deco are unique items which were used a while back, which right now getting them is a bit difficult in the current market.
At Vintage Deco, clients place orders and have to wait for at least a month before the consignment reaches them. The need among homeowners to be unique, especially when it comes to home decor, has created a market for classic pieces.
That report was compiled by Alfred Kitty in Nairobi. To football now, where Ivory Coast kicked off their 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup on a sour note, losing 10-0 to Germany. Apart from Ivory Coast, Africa is represented by Nigeria and Cameroon at the tournament taking place in Canada. The final match is scheduled to take place on July the 5th in Vancouver. I've been speaking to André Leslie, DW Sports editor, on what went wrong with the Ivorians and whether the other two African teams have a better chance of progressing.
From what I saw of the game, Ivory Coast defended very naively. They defended very high, so they let Germany do all sorts of attacking moves, which you shouldn't do when you've got some great strikers like Germany has. So I think it was a bit naive, and Germany was just really cutthroat. They just finished everything off.
And what chances do the other African teams, that's Nigeria and Cameroon, what chances do they have in progressing to the next rounds?
Well, it's going to be really tough. It's going to be really tough, Crispin. I mean, I suppose really you would say Nigeria has the better chance. They're a stronger team. They have a higher world ranking. They're ranked 33rd, so it might be. And they've got some experience getting to the quarters before the Women's World Cup. But they're in a group with US, Australia and Sweden. And especially US and Sweden are very, very tough to beat. Australia is also not bad. So they're going to have their work cut out for them in Group D. Cameroon, well, they've got an easier group. Switzerland, Japan. Japan won the last World Cup, but only a couple of teams need to go through there from the group stage. So it's hard to say. Both of them will need minor miracles, I think, to get to the next round, though.
What is it that you think the African teams need to do to improve their game? You know, like to a level that can match, say, the Germans and the Swedes?
Historically, they've just not been in the final stages of this tournament. And I think that means that there's a lack of experience in these countries, a lack of high-level tournament experience. If it's really hard to just create that overnight, so probably the best way is to get these players playing in the USA or playing in Europe, leagues like in Sweden or the US college leagues. And they're amazing for women's football, and they're really an exciting way for people to learn high-level football that they may not have in their own country. So I think that's probably important to get those players overseas. It would also be probably pretty good to get more sponsorship money into women's football in these countries. Some countries like Sweden, for instance, pay huge wages to their women footballers. That's something that you don't see in Africa. So there are things on all the fronts that need to be improved. But I suppose the main thing is get some top-level experience really fast. And hopefully they'll do it this tournament by getting through to a final stage.
The 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup is the seventh edition of the tournament. Would you say overall the women's game is heading in the right direction?
I think so. We've had some really bad press on FIFA and soccer over the last couple of weeks. Women's football, in comparison, seems very down to earth when you compare it to the big money bribes and corruption that we see sometimes in men's football or in European club football. So it's always had that down-to-earth quality about it. There's no doubt that the Women's World Cup is the biggest tournament in women's football. It has been for quite some time now, I think probably since the US won it and hosted it and made a great show out of it a while back. Probably the key now is to get this tournament going to a place, for instance, South Africa maybe, to get it to somewhere where there hasn't been such great soccer development and to really use it as a big advertisement for the game.
And hopefully if it goes to South Africa, then we hope that there will be no bribery scandal that will come up later on.
That's definitely right. I mean, that would be the worst thing, of course, for this Women's World Cup, for something to come out. I don't expect it will. As I say, it's a bit more down to earth. There's been a little bit controversy about the fact that they're using artificial grass, the women, to play this tournament on. And that's something that's got some of the players pretty annoyed. That would never happen in a men's tournament. So there are still steps that need to be made to really get it up on a par with the men's tournament. But it's coming along. And as I say, it's got a big name for it. And all the best players are there. And that's what you want.
DW's sports editor, André Leslie.
Making a difference.
And Cameroonian Justice Prudence Galega is the one making a difference this week. Cameroon is reputed as a source, transit and destination country for women and children subjected to forced labour and sex trafficking. The situation was made worse by the absence of strong anti-trafficking laws. That was until Justice Prudence Galega created a women association which succeeded in convincing the country's parliament to enact strong legislation. Her efforts have helped to fight child and sex trafficking by prosecuting all those involved. DW's Moki Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Justice Prudence Galega, now technical advisor to Cameroon's Minister of the Environment, feels fulfilled at her effort in enabling women report cases of abuse and violence. She got her inspirations at the 4th Beijing World Conference on Women.
Beijing had raised awareness that women could effectively be agents of change in their communities if they created the space to make their voices heard. And so here comes a little group that started around the graveside of a woman who had died, and they thought that she had not been given sufficient attention.
Justice Galega is referring to Priscilla Leba, a woman who was killed in Bamenda, a town in northwestern Cameroon, for standing up against children being sent into forced marriages. Galega says the death of the lady and the inspiration she got from the Beijing conference motivated her to start a group called Nkumufetfet, meaning our rights, to campaign to protect women and children. Are Merelin says Justice Galega's initiative has been a blessing to many seeking refuge from abuses.
When they take someone, there is an agreement. Either maybe you register for work as a tailor or a hairdresser, or you go to school. And most of the time, they end up just being in the house. They shout at them, even when they are right. At times, they are beaten very brutally.
Justice Galega says children as young as 7 in Bamenda used to be forced to work in the homes of rich people for as little as $20 a month.
You will agree with me today that it's not easy for you to walk into Bamenda and get a little girl of 8 or 7 years and to pay her 5,000 francs or 10,000 a month to take care of your children. Gone are those days when that could happen, because Nkumufetfet was able to get into parliament with victims to advocate the first law that was adopted in this country to convict traffickers in children.
28-year-old Nadege Nge is one of the many children Justice Galega has helped. She was taken from the home of an influential state functionary when she was barely 8. Today, the young lawyer's plans are to defend the rights of women who are going through what she experienced.
For the younger generation, I would say, especially to young women, do not let society dictate who you should be. Be yourself. And it's only then that we can be able to change the world. Because if we don't begin with us, where are we going?
And that report was compiled by Moki Kinzeka in Yaounde. And before we leave you, as always, here's a reminder of our main stories. G7 leaders have pledged to help African countries combat Islamist terror groups in the continent. The UN has accused Eritrea of committing gross human rights violations against its citizens. And we've also been hearing about a Cameroonian legal activist fighting child and sex trafficking. And that's all there is to this edition of Africa Link. Do share your comments and suggestions on the program, either via a text message to country code 491609575950 or an email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. Thank you for listening, and until we meet again on Wednesday, I'm Crispin Mwakideu. Bye for now.